Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips, with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.
Hey.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Testing.
Testing.
Testies.
Testies. 1, 2, 3. I don't know shit about fuck.
Boner.
I like sucking.
Ball.
Legit bad podcast.
Welcome to Costco. I love you.
Where's your home?
Oh, hey there. Before we get started, full credit to Chris at Iron Mountain Tattoo for giving me and Jen some of the coolest tattoos I've ever seen. Also, thanks Tristan, my buddy, my coworker, for hooking us up with him. Enjoy the show.
All right.
All right, let's start this. Let me burp real quick. All right.
Excuse you.
Well, welcome back to Legit Bat. I'm Joe, if it's your first time listening, and Jen is with me today.
Hey,
Ben is not here. Again, even though he said he was going to be, but in his place, we somehow talked Drew from You're Missing the Point to come on the show. Welcome, Drew. Good to see you again,
thanks
buddy.
For having me, guys. As I found out you were having Paul on, I had to, because I must admit, just a little bit of a fan of his work.
Oh, good for you, Drew.
Very nice, very nice.
What an erudite man.
Oh, yes. A real intellectual, Drew, is, despite his ginger appearance. Don't blame him for that.
I would like to consider myself more of a Renaissance man. Yeah. I dabble in a little bit of everything.
Yes.
So, Drew, that red, that ginger, where's that from? Is that Viking heritage or Celtic heritage? Or a bit of both?
A mix of both. My mother's Scottish and my father's family is originally from Denmark.
Superb. Well, I'm a bit of both as well, with Welsh and Danish mixed in there.
I think we're all about the same.
But I don't
level
have the
of
hair.
White.
Don't have the hair to prove it.
Oh, I'm just holding on to mine as long as I can, Paul. So don't worry. I think we all end up getting the receding hairline, the double cowlicks.
Good for you. Well, make the most of it as long as you have it.
He actually put a fresh, bit of glue on it before the show just to make sure it stayed on there. But we are joined tonight by Paul Wallace, an acclaimed author. And if you've never heard of him before, he's written the Eden series. And so unfortunately, I've only listened to the first one because I don't have time to read most of the time. And your first book's the only one that's on audiobook. You got to get the other ones out on audiobook too, please, from me, so I can listen to them.
Well.
But this is your first time on, Paul, and if anybody's ever heard of you or you want to give a quick synopsis of, you know, your work and how you came to what you do, go for it.
Sure. Well, these days I'm known as the Paleo Contact guy, and Paleo Contact is the theory that our ancestors had contact with other civilizations in the deep past, meaning ET civilizations. This is a fairly out there topic, and it surprised me. Is people to know my route into it, because my background is in church-based ministry. I was in church-based ministry for 33 years, working as a theological educator, training pastors in hermeneutics, which is the principles of interpretation of texts and the history of Christian thought. And I worked as a church doctor and an archdeacon for the Anglican Church in Australia, which is one down from a bishop. And it was really... There were two roles, really, that meant I was going to go down some rabbit holes at some point. And one was the church doctoring work, because that includes going to communities that are afflicted by problems, some of which may be pastoral, some may be political, some may be governance. But often there is a paranormal layer to the story as well. And anyone involved in going into community healing in the church world from time to time is going to find they're going to have to engage with that. And that's very stretching to a Western person's worldview. And you have to start opening boxes for categories of reality that you just might not have thought about before. So your worldview begins to get tampered with in that kind of work. But the thing that really got me into Paleo Contact in the end was my work training pastors in hermeneutics. And it was applying all the tools of source analysis, form analysis, linguistic analysis that confronted me with this layer of story in the Bible that is there, is so obviously there that a child will pick up on it. Even reading through a child's Bible, there'll be things not making sense. And when I approach those as hermeneutics questions and as language questions, I realize there's a whole layer of story in the Bible that has not been preached on, has been disregarded, has not been correctly translated, and these are stories of ancient contact. So that was the white rabbit that got me on the journey that produced Escaping from Eden and then all the sequels.
Yeah, I love it. And I love how you said the general, you know, Christian traditional modern philosophy does not like to look at these things because they don't, they want to cling to the things they know, or the things they think they know, and not look into anything else. And the way that you brought up right up the top of the book, the first book, how just the definition of Elohim in the Bible and how it's used and kind of, you know, misused, I guess you'd say, but it, if it's translated correctly, and I know I was listening to your show with Truth Seeker, you just did a couple weeks ago. I was listening to that one, and he brought up the exact same question I was going to, where traditional Christians are going to say, oh, it's plural because it's the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, even though the Son shouldn't have existed then, but since he's also God, he's existed forever or whatever. So I know you've heard that one before, but yes. Just so if people aren't aware,
yeah,
most of the God references in Genesis are Elohim, which is plural, and it means what, the shining ones or the powerful ones?
Powerful ones, yes. So it's the oldest word in the Hebrew scriptures that gets translated as God, but the root meaning is powers or powerful ones. And when you look at how the powerful ones behave in the text, it becomes very clear you're looking at a plurality of beings, because they get into arguments with one another, they go to war against one another, they have conflicting agendas for Project Earth, and when they go to war, thousands of human beings are slaughtered in the crossfire. So when people say, oh, it's plural because it's the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, well, there are two problems with that. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit is New Testament theology. It's not Old Testament theology. There's no Trinity in the Hebrew scriptures, and there's no prophecy of a Trinity. So don't be looking for that. And the other problem is, if it's the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, why do thousands of human beings get slaughtered when they get into an argument? But it goes far beyond that, because as soon as you start reading Elohim in the plural, you realize that many of the Elohim are named. We know the names of El Shaddai, El Elyon, Yahweh, Milcom, Chemosh, Dagon, Asherah. The Elohim are named. Their arrival is commemorated in the plural as well. They are the Tseva Hashemayim, the sky fleet, or airborne armies, to translate that. And then we get glimpses of them in council as well, having arguments about what should happen next. And when I went to those texts where the plurality becomes obvious, and I mean, that starts pretty early. I said these are things a child could point out. I mean, read a Bible with a child, and a child will say, why does it say, let us make the humans to look like one of us, or we don't want them to be too much like one of us. Who's the us? The plurality is there from the get-go. So when I embarked on the research path for Escaping from Eden, I looked at this word that takes plural form verbs. It's a masculine plural form. It exhibits plural behaviors. And I thought, what happens to the stories if I reread them? And instead of translating Elohim as God, which is arbitrary because sometimes it's God, sometimes it's false God, sometimes it's demons, sometimes it's landlords. What if I use the root meaning instead? Reread it as the stories of the powerful ones. As soon as I did that exercise, I recognized what I was looking at as the summary form of the source narratives from out of ancient Sumer, Babylonia, Arcadia, and Assyria. And it becomes quickly clear that the Elohim of the Bible are the Anunnaki of the Babylonian stories and the Tingir of the Mesopotamian stories. And it was seeing that parallel, understanding that dependence, realizing that so many of the God stories with which I was familiar were really summaries of stories of sky people from other cultures' books. That was the red pill that opened up this whole new world for me.
Paul, yeah, I think one of the other aspects that people run into is that we have this perception as Westerners because we've taken on board the Abrahamic faiths as being Western identity at this point. And we fall for this idea that Judaism and Christianity, more so Judaism, is solely monotheistic. But when you look at the history behind the early Hebrew peoples, it was a polytheistic pantheon of gods like you would see within the Greeks, the Romans, the Babylonians, as you mentioned. And it was a ranking tier of different gods. And we have the name Al as listed as a name of God within older scriptures. And we have Al Shaddai. We have Yahweh, as you mentioned before. And you look at these pantheons, you'll find that Yahweh is one of the lesser sun gods or gods of a higher god, a father god above that. So there's this misconception that it's purely a monotheistic religion, but if you look into the archaeology and the theology based on the older Hebrew history, it's a very different story from what the mainstream Western world has grown up with.
Yes, it is. And that change of Judaism from what scholars generally call a polytheistic worldview to a monotheistic one, that change is explained in the Bible itself. If you follow the stories of Kings Hezekiah and Josiah and the high priest Hilkiah and the royal scribe Shaphan and the senior priest Ezra, so go into Ezra, Jeremiah, 1 and 2 Kings, this whole story of reform is told us. So take as an example Jeremiah. He laments the fact that the Jewish people commemorated on every high hill and under every green tree, from every fortified city to every garrison town, Asherah, not Yahweh. They commemorated Asherah with great affection, and they had various rituals of baking cornbread and carrying figurines and music that would be played, incense that would be burned. And Jeremiah tells us that this was the universal practice of the Jewish people, and they remembered Yahweh, who, as you rightly say, was one of the junior Elohim. If you look at Deuteronomy 32, Psalm 82, he's just one of the Elohim, and he's a junior one. Jeremiah says, isn't it awful the way people talk about Yahweh so negatively? They didn't regard the period of direct rule under Yahweh as a golden age at all. They were saying in the 8th century BCE, thank goodness we escaped Yahweh. And that story is told, of course, in 1 Samuel 8, when they decide to get rid of him and have human leadership for human society instead. None of this makes any sense if we take Yahweh as God. How can you fire God and replace him with a human being and think you'll do better on the battlefield? 1 Samuel 8 only makes sense once you realize Yahweh is one of a pantheon. So the Bible itself tells the story of how a Yahwist king, Hezekiah, decides all my people are going to worship my God only, we'll get rid of all the others, and we'll get rid of all the priesthoods that serve them, and we'll demolish all the temples that commemorate them. So this was all Jewish practice. These were Jewish priesthoods, Jewish temples, but we'll get rid of them so we've got one king, one God, one high priestly family, all the tithes coming to Jerusalem instead of all throughout the country to all these other temples, one agency, ministry of information, so to speak, telling you what's true and what's false, what's real, what's fake news. And look, we're going to have an easily manageable theocratic society built on Yahwist monotheism. The whole thing is told us how Hezekiah embarked on these reforms, how Josiah completed them in terms of ritual reforms, and then how Ezra completed the reform of the scriptures. So that now the Elohim, all the other Elohim other than Yahweh, are considered idols, as totems, as ideas. And they've tried to airbrush over the fact that they were peers with Yahweh. They were Yahweh's competitors. But having mapped out the story of how it was changed, how the priesthoods were gotten rid of, how the temples were destroyed, how the scriptures were revised, so on and so forth, it has memorialized forever what Judaism was before. Scholars call it polytheism. I say it's a memory of paleo contact, a memory of real entities who are encountered by the ancestors of the Jewish people.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, obviously for not even just Christians, but for anybody to hear this, I think most people are familiar with the story of the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve and, you know, the whole thing. And you do go into the snake in the Garden of Eden and Lucifer, Satan, devil, whatever you want to call it. How does he fit into this? Is he another one of the Elohim? Is that what that is?
Yes, that's right. Is he another one of the Elohim? Again, see, this is something you read a Bible with a child and they'll immediately say, who's the snake? Where did he come from? How can he can talk? He seems to come from nowhere in the Bible as we know it. But once you read Genesis 3 alongside the older narratives of the Enuma Elish, the Epic of Gilgamesh, the myth of Adapa, you will recognize this narrative as a conflict between two beings known by the Babylonians as Enki and Enlil. They represent factions among our ancient colonizers who had different ideas about how Project Humanity should be advanced. And they had arguments about how many human beings there should be, how long-lived they should be, what access they should have to food, medicine, water. And there's a conflict as to whether we should keep the human beings on the planet at all. And Enlil is the senior of these beings. And he, in the end, says, I've had enough of them. I find them irritating. There are too many of them on the planet. We're going to get rid of them. And he starts off by afflicting them with disease. And then he introduces food scarcity so that it's now by the sweat of their brow that they're going to achieve any ability to feed themselves. And then, oh, this isn't killing enough of them. Let's just have a flood. And it is the longer version of the Genesis 3 to Genesis 6 story, culminating, of course, in the flood of Noah in the Bible. So, in the original version, we've got these visitors who are colonizing, who are interfering in human development, and they have this conflict. The senior one who wants to get rid of the humans is Enlil. The junior one who's on Earth and is hands-on in the development of human beings wants to save them. When we get to Genesis 3, the Enki part has been taken by the serpent, and the senior part has been taken by Yahweh. But we have to remember this isn't the original Hebrew telling of the story. The fact that the name Yahweh is in Genesis 3 tells the reader straight away this is a rewrite, because the name Yahweh hasn't been revealed in the story of the Bible until ages later when Moses comes along. So the fact you've got the name revealed to Moses in Genesis 3 tells the reader this was a previously existing story that's been retold by a writer after the time of Moses who knew the name Yahweh. And he's retelling this story. He's putting these names in. He's putting Yahweh in. He may be putting the snake in. We can imagine originally it was an Elohim story, But we can go further back and realize, oh no, originally this was an Enlil and Enki story. And it wasn't a story about God and sin and disobedience and punishment. None of those were themes in the original. They've been layered over the top by a redactor who wants to teach about sin and righteousness and God and judgment and obedience and all the rest of it. Originally, the conflict and the bad behavior came from the non-human entities in the story, not from the humans. And once you've seen that, it's like scales falling from your eyes, really, because Genesis 3 makes no sense to the Christian reader, because God behaves so appallingly in it. God is the one who is opposed to human progress. He is the one who wants to keep humans so unintelligent they don't even know they're naked. He doesn't want them able to distinguish right from wrong. That level of human thought is not something he welcomes. And yet, despite the fact they have no moral conscience or ability, he's going to punish them for disobeying him. And it's the death sentence for eating a piece of fruit. And any child reading that story is going to think, this is crazy and unjust. And it is the way it's being presented, because it's a distortion of an older story by a redactor wanting to teach about righteousness and obedience from a story that originally had nothing to do with that.
Paul, I often compare the Old Testament. Yeah, I often compare the Old Testament and the New Testament as being almost diametrically opposed stories that are simultaneously occurring for the most part, where that's what we're told as Christians. And I compare the Old Testament to being the dad from the 1960s who would take his belt off and give you a hiding if you look at him the wrong way, whereas Christ in the New Testament is like the new stepdad who accepts everyone, even children that aren't technically his, and he takes you to the ballpark and he buys you an ice cream. They seem like to be very different characters in this broader story. And you mentioned the idea of the Old Testament being written down after the fact. And you and I would know, living in Australia, the power of oral language stories. Our First Nations peoples here in Australia have had an oral language story of their peoples for over 60,000 years. So we have to assume that the Hebrew oral language stories happened for tens of thousands of years before people actually put pencil to paper or to parchment. So there's a level of linguistical drift that occurs over time, let alone someone coming in and writing in the moral framework they want to instill in their people, the laws and the systems they would like to achieve. And I think that this is just the fascinating part of this story. It's not only have we got this story in the Old Testament that's helping build the subconscious and the framework of an entire people, but at the same time, we have this New Testament, which seems to be at odds with the entire story that we've seen up until this point.
Yes, well, that's quite right. And you talk about 60s dad. I mean, he may have been bad enough taking his belt off to teach his kids a lesson, but he didn't do that 70,000 times over with mortal consequences to people who hadn't even offended him.
No, so he didn't feed them snakes either.
He didn't feed them snakes when they wanted food. That's right. So Yahweh is right off the scale. And I think Christians ought to have a head start to realize there's something else going on in these texts, because they are, as you say, diametrically opposed to the morality taught by Jesus and the divine qualities as described by the writers of the New Testament. There is no harmonizing it. You have to gaslight a Christian to make them think these two visions harmonize. They absolutely don't. But the frustrating thing for me is what I'm saying is known to any pastor with a theology degree. We actually have to study these things, including the dependence on the Mesopotamian narratives, at theological college to get our degrees before we get ordained. It is a crazy thing that in academia we have known that these God stories are based on sky people stories since the 1830s. And yet very often, if I mention it on a show, I will get pushback from devout church members who've never heard the like before and think I must be saying this because I'm coming against their faith. And I often say, well, ask your pastor, and I'll often give specific questions they can ask. Ask your pastor, is El Elyon, El Shaddai, Yahweh, Elohim, El, are they one entity? And see what they say. Ask them if our Elohim stories are based on the stories of Anunnaki from the Mesopotamian corpus. And I don't know if anyone has ever done that after I've suggested it, because if they go to someone with a theological degree, the answer will have to be, yes, I did know that. But the dynamics of communities of faith are such that pastors have their doctrine policed not by the college that's just trained them and given their degree, but by the deacons who run their church, or the church wardens, or the council, or the congregation.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.
They sit in judgment over the preacher's doctrine. So if the preacher suddenly comes back and says, ladies and gentlemen, got some news for you, it's not going to be welcome, and they're probably not going to keep their job. It's very difficult to advance this conversation in churches in particular that exist for the sake of a doctrinal basis. I mean, I worked for some years with Assemblies of God in the UK, and they associate on the basis of what's called 12 fundamental truths. And just that language tells you anything that takes you off of those is taboo. And you can't be a minister here, and you're not really welcome here unless you agree with these. So start talking about, yes, but what is the real story of the formation of the Bible? And you'll be given the cold shoulder. So this means the information has been out there for a long, long time at an academic level, but the rank and file of the churches still treat the Bible as if it's a book in a bubble, has no relationship to the Ugaritic stories, the Mesopotamian stories. They'll read the New Testament and Gospels as if they have no relationship to the Greco-Roman stories. But I find as soon as you put them back in context and read these texts for what they are, part of a much wider family of narratives, suddenly you will begin to see them in a different light, and they will make much more sense. Not the sense you thought they made, but something that's actually far more illuminating of human society, human history, and human potential. And that's what I find exciting about reframing these stories.
Well, that, I think the hesitancy, especially from, you know, your typical modern fundamentalist Christian, is that it, by questioning any of this, it's heresy automatically. And so you can't do that. Like you said, the 12 fundamental truths, you can't go outside of that. And if you do, you might lose your job, whatever. I'm glad that you guys brought up the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament, and how it seems like two totally different entities operating under different rules. And, funnily enough, I decided to ask our good old pal ChatGPT the other day some theological questions, which was, I gotta say, it's come a long way since the last time I fucked with it, because it actually had really good laid out, you know, answers, and it made a lot of sense. But that's probably part of the psyop, so don't listen to ChatGPT. But it was interesting, because I basically said, so, you know, the difference between the qualities of God the Father in the Old Testament and God the Son in the New Testament seem, as Drew so poetically put, diametrically opposed. And the answer is basically like, oh, well, God is unchanging, you know, yesterday, today, and forever. That's one of the probably fundamental truths. But his laws can change, or like, you know, a little bit over time because of the current time or the current situation or the population, or, you know, the level of consciousness of man and how far they've come with their, you know, code of morality.
It's like a parent making rules. It's right. Like how parents make rules for their children based on how far they've
come. So ChatGPT was covering for Yahweh the whole time. And I was like, this is odd.
Did ChatGPT do the parent thing of your bedtime when you're six years old is at 7 o'clock? That's bedtime. When you're 12, we can talk about 7:30. That's okay. Things can change.
But it is not the behavior of the human beings that is an issue in the Hebrew scriptures. It is the behavior of Yahweh.
Yeah. And so how does Jesus fit into this as an entity, though? Is it another one of the Elohim or the Shining Ones, or is it a totally different, alien, however you want to think about it?
Well, the Gospels introduce Jesus to us as a person. So this is the canonical Gospels and the extra-canonical Gospels. Introduce him as a person, as a teacher, as a healer. If we're familiar with other Greco-Roman story, then we will recognize he's being presented as the hero who will ultimately be found to be divine, and after his death will ascend and be found among the gods, and there will be signs and visions to prove that he's now among the gods. Jesus absolutely fits into that schema. But of course, we're accustomed to going back to Jesus in the Gospels and reading him through the lens of all the theology that's developed since. And so very often people will come to me and say, Paul, I like your books, but I just want to ask you some shibboleth questions to make sure I should be reading any further. Do you believe that Jesus saves us all from sin? And goodness me, there are probably about a half a dozen doctrines that is really being asked about with that question. And a lot of church doctrine is built, let me put it politely, on sand. There's a doctrine that a lot of other doctrines...
I think you meant shit. I'll say it for you. Shit and piss. Yes.
There's a doctrine that a lot of other doctrines depend on, and it's the doctrine of hell for the non-believer. Hell being eternal conscious torment. And I show in my book, The Eden Conspiracy, that that is not the doctrine of the Gospels. It's not even the doctrine of the New Testament. You cannot support that doctrine on just biblical content. And I take some time over that, a whole chapter in The Eden Conspiracy, showing that that's the case. If you want to believe things that are supportable by the New Testament only, then you're going to have to get rid of that doctrine straight away. And the moment you get rid of hell, then it totally alters how we understand the cross, totally alters what we mean by calling Jesus a savior. It totally alters the rules for the extent to which we will accept Jesus as a human being. So it's taken me some years to think all that through and to accept Jesus as a human being who came and taught. I believe he was a teacher and a healer, and I think his story has been told by people very well versed in Greco-Roman thought, and so they're layering all kinds of tropes into the Gospels as well, so that we'll get that point and realize that he's a hero worth following. So it's, as I say, taking a bit of a while to come back to Jesus, and I find he's a better Jesus than I thought he was. Now I know that he's not endorsing Yahweh and all the violence of Yahweh, that he's not teaching hellfire in the way the churches have. I can just relax and sit at his feet and say, well, pour your teaching into me, because I really think you've got something. And I would count myself a follower of Jesus, have been for 43 years, and my view of Jesus has only been enriched by this journey into the root meanings of key words. But it's a Jesus who is not tribalistic and exclusive in the way I thought he was in the past.
Yeah. And I love that, because I think a lot more people are actually starting to, you know, with the new generation coming up and kind of questioning everything, especially since certain events in 2020, there has been a lot more people that have been looking at things like this differently. And so many people I know that are like, I'm a Christ follower, I love Jesus, I'm not a Christian, but by the way you think about it, I'm not this organized religious Christian church. That, to me, that's the whole bullshit of it, is the organized part of it. And they'll justify that by whatever verse it says, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together. And it's like, at nowhere in the Bible did he say, you got to get together, throw money in the tin at church every week so your pastor can get a Learjet. That was never in the deal. He said, don't forsake the assembling of yourselves together. That could be me and her at night being like, hey, do you want to meditate on some scripture? You know, it could be any of that. It's not going to church by the thousands and dumping money in these people's pockets, which I know is that's kind of hyperbolic to the general. I no offense to all the Christians out there who don't do that, but
okay, Americans do it very well, though, Joe. They love the big institutionalized churches with tithing and millions, right?
They do.
It's their favorite.
And they're proud of it.
Joe, what you've described is at one end of the spectrum, but when I became a Christian, I went to a really lovely church. There was a really lovely community where people were having genuinely powerful and beautiful experiences. But I had some questions, which was, we seem to be investing all our resources into putting on services from week to week. Where's that in the Gospels? And clearly there's clear blue water between what Jesus was on about in the Gospels and what we were doing. And I could never quite get an answer to that question. Same. And similar when it came to, dare I say, more important questions like, why do we consider God as referred to by Jesus as being the God of the Hebrew scriptures, when the behavior of the God of the Hebrew scriptures is so appalling? How is it that we justify things that would be the worst crimes against humanity?
He works in mysterious ways, bro.
Yes, that's right. And you get answers like that. So for some time I was thinking, this isn't quite adding up. How can I have compassion for somebody going to hell and God doesn't? How can I think it's unjust to give an infinite punishment for a finite crime? How can I be morally more developed than God? That doesn't make any sense at all. And why do we treat a document that clearly has a human history that evolved as if it came down in a bubble and can be regarded as some kind of divine oracle? Every believer starts off with these questions, and they will either stop asking them, get too busy to remain curious, or they will be gaslighted by the church to say, oh, no, it's not really a problem. But when you become a pastor, when it becomes your responsibility to teach from the scriptures, it becomes a little bit harder to run away from these things. Personally, you might not have the opportunity to preach on all your thought processes, but if your job forces you to read all these stories and keep confronting yourselves with the problems of harmonizing one vision of God with another, then at some point you're going to have to start making some decisions. And it took me a long time to reach that point because of the business thing. Your job is to keep the show on the road, not to pursue your intellectual curiosity. I was just very lucky that the way my career shaped out, it had a few gaps in it in between assignments where I could pursue the scriptures, pursue the anomalies in the stories we tell from them, and realize there is an answer to why these things don't make sense. And the answer might take me onto some unfamiliar territory, but I just cannot avoid the data and I cannot avoid the logic. And I was lucky that when I pursued the word Elohim, I wasn't pastoring a congregation, that I had the freedom just to examine and explore the text, to understand it with as clear a head and as clear a conscience as possible. And ultimately, it took me to a place where I don't think I'll be applying for any more congregational jobs, because the conclusions I've come to are controversial in any church, whether it's Assemblies of God, Church of England, or anything. There will be a mix of opinion on these things. And some of these areas really are a taboo and have been for a very long time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think that's what some of the Elohim were probably counting on when they maybe took something out of our brain or put some sort of interrupter in there, as you've discussed before. That's a possibility that they've wanted humanity to be stupid in a way, to not be able to have the foresight to think, wait, do I have more moral grounds than my creator, than, you know, something that's supposed to be above me? I've been taught to think I'm lower than. But
that's right.
Possibly there's some of those Elohim out there that are less than. They're like the bullies at school that don't want to, you know, grow and learn and develop.
Well, and it's so funny because it works so well, though, too, because I know the way I grew up, it was like, you are less than God. God made all of this and you're just one of them. And the more you experience life and learn about all these things, it's like, okay, I would never say, because I do believe there's a God, I would never say I'm a God myself. That's ridiculous New Age thinking to me, in my opinion, to say I am God too. That's ridiculous. I mean, I don't know, but I would say more like, I don't think God thinks of us as his lessers, or like we're just some ants that
if there's multiples, though, is what I'm saying. If there's an Elohim and there's a faction of the Elohim that think, hey, I recognize that there's something strong in these beings that we've created where they could possibly figure something out and maybe overtake us or surpass us in some way. And maybe they're just thinking, I don't want that to happen. It's just someone holding someone's head down and saying, no, you'll never get there.
Yes, that's right. And what you're saying, Jen, is absolutely right. If you've got an advanced being with a better weapon than you've developed, that creates a certain pecking order. If you layer over the top of that the language of worship, now you're saying, wow, look at that amazing weapon. Look at the powers of our God. And if you're looking at a powerful being with a powerful weapon, suddenly the saying, the fear of the powerful one is the beginning of all wisdom, it makes a certain new kind of sense. We have the weapons described to us, the Keli Mashito, the Keli Mapasoa described in Ezekiel, which can ethnically cleanse an entire district if you've got six of those weapons in the hands of six individuals. If you read that with an open eye, you're thinking, oh my goodness, I'm glad I wasn't around when those beings turned up with those weapons. Read it through the lens of worship and, oh, isn't God great? And the problem...
And next thing you're goose-stepping and you don't even know
yes,
why.
Yes, exactly. And you become what you worship. If you justify the xenophobia of a xenophobic God who thinks in terms of my people and not my people, you have to think in exactly the same terms. If you worship a God who despises adult women, despises their biology, despises their menstrual cycles, but always asks as tribute groups of virgin girls, you're going to have to get your head into that headspace. You're going to have to worship that and become that. If you worship a God who invades other people's countries, countries that have never heard of you, and consider yourself justified in whatever violence is necessary to take control, well, now you've got an imprimatur to do exactly the same thing when you invade someone else's country.
Not to interject too much, but I got to cut you off there because this sounds exactly like the roots of Gnosticism. Do you ever catch shit for that?
Well, people keep telling me this. Paul, you sound like a Gnostic. And... I'm not in the sense of being a devotee of all the literature that we call Gnosticism, but maybe I am in the sense that I'm very interested in going back to what Christianity was in the beginning, before the process of canonization and orthodoxization. In the beginning, Christianity was a kaleidoscope of ideas and documents and theologies and experiences, and the taboos that we have today that we're so familiar with, and many of the doctrines we have, were not there. And I find that kaleidoscope exciting and inspiring. So if that makes me a Gnostic, then perhaps I am.
I think Gnostic has become the throwaway term, like the boogeyman. And if you're a fundamentalist Christian, it's quite easy to throw someone into that box if they think outside the the box of what standard theology is. And you mentioned a really key word quite earlier on, Paul, logic. And I tend to put my lens of my theological and faith-based research through the three aspects of faith, logic, and reason. What's the reason behind God doing this? What's the logical side of this? And is there a faith-based reason for that? And unfortunately, what I'm finding is that a lot of people who find their way into the church or follow Christ later on in life, those are the first questions that you ask. You look at the Old Testament, you see these stories that just don't make sense for a human being. And the quick throwaway line or excuse you'll get is, that was because that was those people, and those people were of the bad bloodline, and they had to be dealt with. God told them to. But yeah. Then if you put it through the historical lens of things, just look at the story of Exodus. Exodus yes. tells us a story of Moses and his people were persecuted by the Egyptians, and they were freed. But you look into the historical context roughly around the same time period, and you have a story of the people called the Hyksos, which were a Levantine people, most likely a Canaanite tribe, who actually invaded North Egypt, ruled over there for a kingdom for quite a long time, and were eventually kicked out. So I'd like to get your take on this. Is there a possibility that the Hyksos could have just written themselves in as the victims after the fact?
Oh, that's a great question. I haven't looked into that storyline to see how it correlates. So you might know more than I do from that angle. But what I would say is this, that with the Exodus story, it's often told by Yahweh as the reason that the Hebrew people and the Jewish people should be grateful to him and loyal to him in exclusion of all others. I'm the one who brought you out of Egypt. I'm the one who saved you. I'm the one who fed you in the desert, etc. But the framing of that story gives another perspective. If you look at Deuteronomy 32 and Psalm 82, there's a reference to a post-invasion moment after the Tzeva Hashemayim have arrived. So after the Sky Fleet has landed, these advanced beings have come out. What they're now doing is dividing the spoils of their conquest, dividing up the lands among the Elohim. And El Elyon, which means the powerful one higher than the other powerful ones, is distributing lands. And the idea is that if you own the land, then you own the humans on the land and the resources under the land. Yahweh is shown in this moment to be a junior Elohim, because he gets a people group with no land. El Elyon.
Are you talking about tiny hats? Just so we're clear. Tiny hats?
The Hebrew tribes.
The
I think he's referring to the Hebrews. He's asking if the people he was given were the Hebrew tribes.
Yes, so that's right. So at that point, it's the tribes of Israel, the people of Israel.
Tiny hats.
They are living in Egypt. And so Yahweh's first action is to get his people group out and then find land for them, because in his infinite wisdom, El Elyon has created this artificial scarcity, divide and conquer, even over the Elohim. And so Yahweh's going to have to go to war with other Elohim to get some land for his people group. That's the Exodus story. It's not, we were suffering and then this great God came and rescued us. No, you were given to one of the Elohim as a possession to do with as he pleased, which is exactly what he did do with great violence and with no fellow feeling or father's heart at all, if you read the story to the end. So the Exodus is not what it seems as soon as you put it in its biblical context, let alone the wider historical context that you're suggesting, Drew. But ask me again in another year. We might have an interesting conversation on the point you raised.
Well, I'm finding it just so interesting that Christ came along and turned the entire religion of the Hebrew people on their head. He had to tell them and reinterpret their scriptures because what they were teaching was wrong. And he came to correct the word of God. And he referred to God quite often as Abba, as the Father. And I find it quite interesting that we have this story of the Exodus that led to the tribes of Israel and the founding of Israel, Judea. And when Christ was a young boy, when he had to flee his own homeland, he grew up and learnt a lot of his education in Egypt, which just seems like a perfect place to have maybe gained this ancient knowledge of the Exodus story and the things that really occurred. And he was able to bring the truth back to his people when he returned as an adult man.
Yes, I think there was far more opportunity than people generally realize for someone of Jesus's generation to have had a pretty good education in terms of international thought. I mean, if you read Plato, that's 400 and a bit years before Jesus, and he's produced this wonderful synthesis of international thought, which included Eastern thought and Egyptian thought. And that thought was what the writers of the Gospels and New Testament breathed in and out without thinking by the time Jesus came along. And is it possible that Jesus knew as much about international thought as those who wrote for him? It's possible. I mean, he lived in Egypt. There's that huge chunk of his life missing. It could have been anywhere during that time.
Wasn't there some people said he also went to Japan?
India says he went to India, and Japan says he went to Japan. England says he went to England. everyone wants a piece of the story, but on what basis would you just dismiss that, since the Gospels are actually silent on where he was for those years? But
conspicuously silent.
Was possible for a person to get a pretty decent education in international thought. And it crops up in the Gospels, for instance, when Jesus asks his 12, who do people say I am? And one of the answers is, oh, some people think you're a reincarnation of one of the prophets, or a reincarnation of John the Baptist. Well, where did that come from? Reincarnation isn't Jewish thought, but it is part of Eastern thought. It is part of what Plato talked about, and it's part of what the early church fathers talked about. So you've got this world of very developed philosophy and theology. It's there before Jesus. It's there in the writers of the Gospels and New Testament. It's there in the church fathers. But Jesus didn't know anything about any of this, really? Well, what makes you say that? So I think we need to recontextualize Jesus, put him back into his moment, and realize what the start point was for people reading the Gospels and New Testament. When the original readers were reading Paul, they would have recognized the dozen Plato quotes in Paul and the various other Greek writers who he quotes like he knows it, like the back of his hand. We won't understand the Gospels and New Testament in their original form unless we approach them through the lens of Greco-Roman thought. But our habit as evangelical believers, fundamentalist believers, is to see the Bible in a bubble, as if it bears no relationship to anything else. It is the truth, everything else is false. It is pure, everything else is a perversion. So that if you read it that way, you read the Gospels, if you then go to Egypt and find half a dozen very similar stories, well, you'll say, obviously, this is the devil creating fakes, decoy stories. And people do actually say things like that, rather than saying, oh, now I see the family of stories, of which the Jesus story was a part.
It's funny, I think the devil has so many names too. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to jump in and say that we often mistake the time frame in which Jesus lived as well. And like you put forward, philosophical ideas had been a part of the ancient world for a very long time. And we have this weird view of the ancient world that Christ lived in as this very dark, terrible place, but it was highly sophisticated. The use of Greek in the time was like the modern day English of its day. Everyone spoke it. People spoke multiple languages, different cultures, different nations were integrated. We had the Alexandrias operating in libraries that were free and open to people who wanted to pursue knowledge and truth. Yes. And it was a very interconnected world. They didn't have the technology of the internet. They didn't have modern day jets to take people around. But the interconnected ability for people to communicate and share their stories was across the breadth of the Mediterranean.
Well, you say they didn't have jet set around the world, but international travel was so advanced at that time that the Roman Empire would send people to a posting up at Hadrian's Wall that lasted 24 months. So you've got to be able to travel pretty quickly for that to make any sense at all, because you don't want your troops out of action half the time because they're traveling, you know, between postings. A 24-month posting, that distance, and that's right to the edge of the Roman Empire, tells you it would have been not so hard for Jesus to have traveled, or those who wrote for him to have traveled, be that to India, Egypt, Africa, or anywhere else.
So that brings up something I was kind of thinking of. I don't know if you cover this in your later books, but what do you think of this idea, the Christian idea that's come along the last couple of years about the little season of Satan? Have you heard about that theory at all?
No.
Okay, so I was gonna try to decide between Revelation, what you think about what Revelation means yes. in this worldview, and okay. also the little season, which is the idea that the events in Revelation happened a long time ago, like back in 79 AD, I think they say,
yeah.
and that
yeah.
Jesus ruled for 1,000 years, and now he loosed Satan, which is, this is all in Revelation apparently, and then, so we're in the season of Satan right now, which is the season of deception. In theory, that idea makes sense to me, but where do you come at it from your worldview?
I think Revelation is more a cocktail of stuff than perhaps we generally recognize. We treat it as a single work. It's got a start and a finish, but it's not all the same thing from start to finish. It is a sequence of visions and possibly experiences. And I do think parts of it refer very specifically to the first century of the Common Era and to things that were happening at that time. But those things are examined with such insight that the principles of empire that you're reading about are really universal. And so readers of Revelation have been able to read Revelation in every age since it was written and believe it was talking about the present day, because its understanding of the governance of empires is really very, very shrewd. And so, you know, there are people today who say this is definitely describing what's happening right now with the appointment of the new pope and the appointment of the new president. That's now, isn't it? The reason people have said that for 2,000 years is because of the insight and understanding of the dynamics of governance that are written into that book, but which were originally being leveled not against the United States of America or Brussels, but against the empire of the day, which was Rome. I think we've got a sequence of visions that have very developed religious themes, and they are a religious message for a religious audience. But I think we've got apocalyptic in Revelation as well, which is where the writer has seen some stuff, and he's either seen it in the real world or in a vision, and he doesn't really know what he saw and doesn't understand what he saw. So he's just going to describe it as faithfully as he can so that the reader then has to interpret.
He's describing an acid trip, and we're left to try to figure out what happened.
So there's an interest in that. Yes, you could see it that way. But for me, I'm interested in a moment where he describes a giant cube that comes down from the sky that can house tens of thousands of people, that has what we would call artificial lighting and all the systems that can support a massive human population before that cube has the universe fold away from it, and it goes somewhere where all of a sudden there's a new sky and a new earth, meaning an unfamiliar planet and unfamiliar stars. That may be something the writer actually saw, and he might be describing what today we would call a breakaway civilization. But he doesn't use those words, and because it's all enmeshed among all the other texts, we're not quite sure if he's describing something that's going to happen on planet Earth. Can't be. It's a new Earth, isn't it? And it's called the New Jerusalem. It's called a city, but is a city cube-shaped? And how do we explain the artificial lighting that's described in an era before it was invented? So I think there are all sorts of things going on in the book. And if you try and systematize it into a single thing in a single timeline, I think that's where we begin to make mistakes. When I was working for AOG, it was very important to be able to say if you're an amillennialist or a postmillennialist or a premillennialist, I can't even say the words anymore. And I think it's those are the wrong questions, because you just have to take each section of Revelation on its own terms, and work out what's this bit about, because it is a whole sequence of things. It's not a single thing.
Yeah, and there's a lot of I've listened to a lot of it. And are you familiar with astrotheology, where people break down things like the Bible and other texts, and are like, these are stories of the stars, and a lot of it does make sense, where they're pointing to different constellations, the Virgin who is full of the sun or whatever. There's all these weird words, and a lot of it does show up in Revelation too. But it does, you can correlate it to the star constellations, but then you got to ask how long have those interpretations of the stars been around, and what they meant by them, and what do you think of that whole area?
Yes, I think the fascination with the stars is really intriguing. It's not developed, in my view, in the Hebrew scriptures. Suddenly it is in the Book of Enoch. It certainly is in ancestral story from around the world. And different regions have a fascination with different regions of space, which I find intriguing. So there are cultures that are very fixed on the Pleiades, because they believe that's where our ancient tutors came from.
Or
Others fixed
Orion.
on, or Orion, that's right, or Sirius or Cygnus. And I think the stories of helpers coming from those places, and then the existence of archaeological sites that would appear to be observatories orientated on those different positions in space, again suggest to me that something was experienced that made people hopeful that we might see visitors from those places once again. And last year I spent some time in Turkey looking at the ancient sites of the Bianili, the Urartian people who lived there in the Bronze Age, and they had stories of ancient helpers coming from Cygnus, and a lot of their cultural activity was oriented around encouraging the Tingia, these advanced beings, to come back. And it involved being oriented towards the right part of space. And so I wonder if there's that elsewhere in ancestral story. I haven't looked for it in the New Testament in particular. It's not something I've pursued, but it's something that catches my attention.
Well, what's your position on, say, science in general? Like I mentioned before, I'm someone who takes on board science. I don't throw the baby out with the bathwater in this regard. I think science is a fantastic mechanism we use for understanding God's creation and the world we live in. There's a lot of historical precedents of events, cataclysms, the end of the Younger Dryas period, in which the mile-high ice caps in North America flash flooded and flooded most of the Northern Hemisphere. So we've got tales that we can equate to the flood, but we've also got tales of which there were multiple humanoids living on the world at one point, as little as 150,000 years ago. Cro-Magnon man just snapped and appeared on the scene, the most sophisticated human being that had ever existed, but was living alongside at least 12 other walking upright humans, akin to a J.R. Tolkien Lord of the Rings world with dwarves and elves and all
That's
these
right.
different creatures.
Yeah.
It seems as if there's some kind of a hand, whether that's what your proposition is in your books of ancient astronaut type of theory or incursions of more evolved entities. But it also could be a spiritual side of things as well, that for whatever reason, a new humanoid appeared and either wiped out its competitors or integrated with them. And we've got these an amazing whole community of the human race right now. We're so varied and so different that we've all got this one single source of a Cro-Magnon ancestor. Where's your position on that? Could this have been the ancient astronaut mingling with humanity that was available at the time, or could there still be a spiritual side to things as well?
Well, I think it's possible that in our fossil remains, we do have the remains of visitors. The visitors appear to have been very, very similar to us, if we take ancestral story seriously, similar enough to have done gene splicing, which is suggested by Hebrew story, Babylonian story, Mesoamerican story, Greek story, Norse story. They all suggest that our development as Homo sapiens was tweaked in some kind of a way. And some really interesting visual ways of describing that have been given to us. So I've become persuaded that our arrival in our current form was assisted through external interventions. And when we read the Mayan account in the Popol Vuh, it's very open about the difficulty that our visitors had in finessing, this comes back to what you were saying, Jen, in finessing a species that was clever enough to be a useful working class, but not so smart that it's then difficult to manage us. And various dead ends happened in this long period of experimentation, according to the Popol Vuh. And these experiments resulted, the writer says, in us, plus the ape-like creatures who live in the forest. Now, when I first read the Popol Vuh, I raised both eyebrows at that because I thought, well, that's extraordinary, because that writer, long before Charles Darwin ever comes along the scene, is saying we and ape kind share a common ancestor. That's what that says. And that us plus our primate neighbors all arrived here, not by random processes, but through interventions. Ape-like creatures who live in the forest plus us. And then I put that back alongside what I was taught at school about human evolution, where there's this neat single line progression going from Australopithecus, gradually getting taller and straighter, paler skinned, more clean shaven, until you've got, I don't, probably when I was at school, until you've got the British, you know, this.
That's all Darwin standing there.
But yeah, that's right. And we have learned so much about human origins since that time that tells, that describes, just as you say, it was a nice way to put it, Drew, a Tolkien-esque world where you've got giants, hairy people, short people. You've got the dragon people of China. You've got Homo floresiensis, from Indonesia, who is like a little hobbit with big feet. You've got, what is it? I never say his name right. The giant one, Gigantopithecus, us, Denisovans, Neanderthals, all living together, interbreeding. There was a spectrum of hominids and hominins on the planet, which it would make perfect sense that we would have ancestral stories of, what would we call them? Hobbits, little people, hairy people, giants, because that is our ancestral memory of what it was like living here. And I do believe there's a story in the Bible from a very, very early time in the human experience where we, Homo sapiens sapiens, were trying to work out how to live in this plural world and have the upper hand. Because we have the story of two different kinds of human. A smooth-skinned one, who's very wily, and one that's covered in hair, who is much stronger, but not as bright. So this is...
That's the Yeti to you guys, right? Or no, is it Yowie?
This is Jacob Yowie. And Esau. Yeah, that's right. This is Jacob and Esau in the Bible. And the way it works out is that the smooth-skinned one learns to manipulate the hairy one through offerings of food. Well, that's how you tame animals. That's not a brother-to-brother relationship, which is the context of the story in the present. That is smooth-skinned humans working out how we are going to survive in a world where some of the other hominids are stronger than us. They might not be as smart, but they're stronger. We can manipulate them with food. We can make peace treaties with them in that way. That's a really intriguing story. It's one
That's
of those
not much
anomalous
different than horses.
Stories.
I mean,
yes, exactly. It's yeah. how you what, tame horses. And
Paul, it aligns perfectly with the idea of these Elohim being gifted their own kingdoms, for a lack of a better word. They're given territory and they're given control over the people in those areas. If there was a large selection of different upright walking hominids in different parts of the world, naturally the person who gets control of, say, Europe, they would notice that there's Neanderthal in the area, so they'll start splicing with the Neanderthals. The person that has Asia Minor in Asia would notice that there's Denisovans in that area. They'll start splicing that certain human. Every single modern-day human race is a development of ancient human admixtures. We all have one common ancestor, but the people that you partnered up with are slightly different groups. So it almost allows for the racial groups within this world, as well as the different areas across the planet. The Elohim were taking advantage of the founding stock of whatever area they had available to them.
It seems kind of disheartening that after however many years you believe of, you know, this splicing or this genetic experiment that we call Earth has been going on, we've somehow in 2025 settled on Homo retardus. Literally both of those.
Well, let's not get too down on ourselves, because according to our ancestors, our intelligence level is very deliberately suppressed by those who govern us. If those who govern us are anything like those who governed us in the past. And so you've got a really interesting story that comes from Nigeria of a Basi and a Tai. And these are two advanced non-human beings who turn up and they foster the beginnings of humanity. They're the ones who create a new kind of human and reach the point where they can be made fertile and they can start producing their own population. Once they've got them to that level, a Basi and a Tai go on a holiday. They, by the way, live on an island in the sky, which I love that motif, because Plato talks about beings who live on islands in the sky as well. And it's, if you picture that, now you're picturing what the Vedas described as flying cities, so on and so forth. Well, so they go off on their island in the sky for a holiday. They come back. The humans have multiplied, become a civilization. And a Basi and a Tai said, this was not what we had in mind. This is going to be really difficult to manage. They are so numerous and they're so intelligent. We cannot just dominate this environment anymore. How are we going to keep the upper hand? And it's the female, Atai, who goes away and comes up with a solution. If we release devices into the environment that will diminish their physical health, so that they're always a bit sick, they've always got something to worry about, and diminishes their mental health, so there's always this anxiety that they're wrestling with, now we can manage them. It's similar to the Popol Vuh story, where the feathered serpents realize the human beings are too smart. We've got too good an ability to anticipate. Our future viewing is too good. Our farsight is too good. Our telepathic connection is too good. Can't manage these, they say. So Kukulmats goes away, comes up with a solution, a vapor that when sprayed over human beings, brain damages them, brings them down to the point where they're only aware of what's right in front of them, their five physical senses, and for anything else, they're going to need to rely on an authority to tell them what's what. We can work with that. Both those stories say that human beings are fundamentally super intelligent, capable of more than we generally realize, but that things have been put into the environment to damage our health and to damage our mental health, to ensure that we're kept at a lower level, manageable. And it's a horrible story. I mean, why would anyone invent that story? It doesn't glorify the ancestors. It doesn't glorify the gods. But there's a positive take home from it, which is that if you can maximize how clean your environment is, how clean your air is, how clean your food is, how clean your water is, now you're giving your body and your brain the best chance to operate with higher cognitive function than we generally accept. And I find that a very positive message.
And it's backed up by Android.
Well, we all went off.
Sorry, I totally agree, but I think there's another positive message in that they've talked about in the Bible that they could wipe us out at any moment. The flood, they're multiple times, but they're not. They're thinking, how can we slow them down a little bit instead of just killing us like bugs? You know, like if there's a bee's nest outside my house, I just call pest control and say, get rid of it. It's not, you know, I don't care about them. But if my kid's acting up, someone I care about, I wouldn't say, okay, I wouldn't call someone and just get rid of it. You know what I mean? So they obviously care about us in such a way that they want to keep us alive. Because it sounds like, I don't know how you feel about this, it sounds like they have the power to wipe us out at any moment, but they want us to survive in a way.
Yes, I think you're right, Jen. And among the stories of the Sky Council, or the Ba'adat El, as it's called in the Hebrew scriptures, is a suggestion that the destructive power of more exploitative visitors is held at bay by others in high places who think more highly of us. So that is part of long-standing ancestral story. And if we bring it to the present day, I can tell you that there are units within your military intelligence community, Jen, who are looking at the question of how come we're still here? Because if I go to Plato, for instance, he argued that every 5,000 years or so, something will happen to virtually wipe out civilization, so we have to start from scratch. And if he's right, then we're about 7,000 years overdue. And US military intelligence is interested in working out why that hasn't happened. How come we are still here? How come it is 7,000 years overdue? And is it because we have helpers whose technology is advanced enough to prevent another dinosaur extincting asteroid hitting the planet, for instance?
Yeah, it sounds like so if we're created in the image and likeness of the gods, so to speak, they might have their own military intelligence that's holding other people back, other entities back. So they have their own politics, their own leaders, their own, you know, militaries. It's the same as us. We're doing the same thing. It's like macrocosm, microcosm, and we're the littles, you know?
It's an awakening moment, exactly, though, isn't it? It's an awakening moment that there's also the other side of things with there's entities that don't particularly care about us too much, that we've had mass cataclysms in humans' history of pestilence, disease. Human race was supposedly dwindled down to as little as 1,000 individuals at one point. So potentially these guys have tried to manage us a little bit harder than what we would like. I really love the point that you brought up with humanity's potential has been reduced somewhat. And we can see that with the anthropological record of proto-humans, Neanderthals, Denisovans, having larger cranial capacities than what we have today. And we think of them as dumb cave people that were dragging their knuckles around. They had a larger cranial capacity than us. It's just not noticeable because they had an occipital bun that would stick out the back of their head. Ours is reduced, yet we're supposed to be far smarter than what they were. I think that there's probably, if there was genetic tampering, there's a lot of little things have been placed within our DNA to slow us down a bit. And I think that's really relevant in the genetic disorders modern humans have. Compared to the animal kingdom, we have far more genetic disorders than what we should have based on the idea of evolution.
Dude,
we
not to get too woo on that same idea, though, but it seems like everybody kind of is realizing that, too, where you're like, you know what? We're right on the verge of something. Like, we know something, but it's just not coming to the forefront. Like how it's like there's a block or a veil, as the Bible talks about a veil. Like,
well, you know, like I think it's an amazing time we're in because I'm contacted on a daily basis by readers of every age all around the world. And I have been amazed by the number of people in their 70s, 80s and 90s who contacted me saying, you know, I just don't believe anymore what I was taught about human origins or human potential or our place in the cosmos. And I have an appetite on me to find out what's really going on, who we really are, what we're really capable of, what company we're really keeping in this universe. And I've not seen this level of excitement and curiosity and pursuit of new knowledge in my life. This is a very unusual season that we're in right now. And it's a perfect time for me to be writing the books I write, because there is such an appetite out there to be asking these questions.
Yeah, and I love that. You just do. I mean, I'm not saying you don't believe anything. You do ask these questions, though, and posit that to people. Like, think more about this. You're not necessarily telling them how they should feel. You're just saying, well, maybe don't believe so hard in one thing so that you can be open to something else. And I love that people of all ages are coming around to these new ideas, because I think as an entire species, things like telepathy or psychic visions, things like that, or I don't know, any experience with God, those are all things that are, I think you could ask any person in the whole world, hey, have you ever had a psychic moment, like you were just thinking of somebody, or, you know, something, yes, you were thinking of a word and it popped up on the radio, something like that, something kind of stupid, but we let it go. Like, it's no big deal. We don't talk about that. But every single person on this whole earth has had that experience, I believe. I don't think one person is more special than the other. Maybe some people are more open to those things, but this magical world is available to us, and there's something about us that we just don't want to believe it. I think it's maybe something that long ago was put into us or taught into us. It could have just been a word that we read, or something like the Bible that tells us we're supposed to be a certain way. We're such impressionable creatures. It's so easy to manipulate us. So we want to belong. We want to believe in what other people say, you know, just as a humanity, because we want to be a part of a team in a way. So, but all of these things, because one person doesn't believe, it's kind of like being at school in the cliques, you know, someone says something like, oh, that's not cool. So you're just like, oh, this thing I thought was really cool, like this weird telepathy experience I had isn't cool because, you know, my whole church doesn't believe it or whatever. That's just a random example. But I think if we talked more about these things, we'd all just consciously open up so much more and grow. And it doesn't have to be wooey or weird. We could just talk about it and have if we all had an open mind, I think it would just spread so much faster.
Well, I think the human race, especially now, is very distractible very easily too. And now everybody's got their heads in their phones, assholes, all day, and just walking around like this, and they're not looking at the sky. They don't give a shit about these things we're talking about.
Well, they don't even want to be around people. People are so introverted now, and now it's trendy to be an introvert and not talk to your neighbors.
It's trendy to be autistic now.
Well, isn't the worst prison, though, the prison of your own mind and the system that build in our perceptions of the world?
I mean, definitely. I think we all need to connect.
I think if we can get people out of their post-lockdown poor social habits and put them in a group to have a drink together or a meal together, and ask the question, have you ever experienced anything that you couldn't explain? I don't think there would be a family group or a friendship group anywhere that would be absent of a story. And I reckon every individual in any group would have a story of that kind. And if we would create those opportunities and have those conversations, listen to each other's stories of the unexplained, I don't think it would take too long before you'd begin to think, we might have more company than we generally get taught.
Yep, exactly.
Or that, you know, that isn't demonized by the mainstream and saying you're full of shit because that doesn't happen in science.
True. Yeah. And the same with what you mentioned, Jen, about psychic phenomena. I think if you ask people, have you ever had a moment where you knew who was calling you before you picked the phone up and it was someone you hadn't heard from in, you know, a year or 2 years, whatever. Everyone says, yes, that happens. That happens to me all the time, some people will say. Have you ever had the experience where you knew exactly what your spouse was going to shout from the other room? Yes, it happens all the time. And have you ever had the experience where your child suddenly spoke the adult thought you were thinking in your head? Yes, it happens with our youngest all the time. I think these are the kind of stories it's great to pull, because it gives us the hint that we can do more, that we're capable of more. And again, busyness often takes us away from pursuing these things. But I think it's really exciting to realize I might be better at far sight than I thought. I might be better at future sight than I thought. And if we were operating with more of our brains in the on position, well, how might that affect our decisions as a family from month to month, year to year? How would that affect our politics if we were all thinking that little bit more intelligently? How would that affect the way we do business? It could be really far-reaching.
Yeah, I feel like that's what Jesus was trying to teach us in the New
Yes,
Testament.
agreed.
So I always talk about this Bible phrase, but Mark 11:20 is one of my favorite ones. It's the parable of the withered fig tree. But I feel like Jesus was trying to tell us, in a way, so he wasn't, he was like an almost like an Elohim that came down as an avatar and was like, hey, I'm going to mingle with the humans and show them what they can be, but from like a parental perspective. I'm going to show them the best way they can be, and let them go without saying everything, without, divulging the full truth. I want them to figure it out on their own. You know what I mean? So he said, if a man says to a mountain, go and throw yourself into the sea, if you don't doubt in your heart, but believe that what you said will happen, this will come to pass. So it's like he's saying, that's a ridiculous thing. Who would want to take a mountain and throw it into the sea? It was just an example of
Israel.
you can move mountains, you can do anything you want if you believe you can do it. But he did it with these physical examples of things that sound ridiculous to us, that sound impossible. So we have to have the belief so small as a mustard seed to believe that we can do these things. But he doesn't really say how to do it. He just lets us know
No.
we can do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this has been awesome, dude. I really appreciate you taking time. I'm glad we could figure out our schedule differences, and also glad that Drew could join. Good to see you,
Yeah,
buddy.
thank you so much.
Before we get
Yes.
out of here, do either of you, we'll go in line, ladies first, have any other questions or comments you want to give to Paul before we
Nope,
get out of here?
I just asked my final or said my final piece, but I appreciate it very much. Thank you so much.
Drew, the
Yeah,
mic's on
thanks
you.
for having me on, guys. It's absolutely an absolute pleasure to actually get to speak to Paul after reading his books. I'm gonna have to do the selfish thing, Paul. I'm gonna have to send you an invite to come on my podcast for the future as well while I've got you
All
on screen.
right, let's do that.
You
You might
Perfect.
be able to do it in person. I mean, how far are
Well,
you
there we
from
go.
each other?
So, where are you, Drew?
I'm in Victoria.
Oh, okay. Cold Victoria. I
Oh.
live very happily in Victoria for 3 years in Healesville, and we
Oh, right. There you go.
absolutely
Wow.
loved it there. But now I live in the subtropics, and when I think of Victoria, I'm afraid I only remember the cold weather.
Yeah, Poms don't come to Australia to live in Victoria. They go to Queensland.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I might make the trip for you, Drew. You never know.
Fantastic.
That would be awesome. My last little thing before we get out of here, where do you think that brings us in the cycle of the universe or whatever you want to call this? I know we kind of touched on Revelation and Genesis, so is this a cyclical thing? Like what are you seeing for the next 5 to 10 years? I usually ask guests this from their perspective, of course.
Oh gosh, I think there's so much on the table right now for human beings living on planet Earth. Geopolitics has become extremely interesting, and the opportunity is there for whole nations to think very intentionally about what kind of future they want to build. So, I mean, it's frightening, it's disturbing in parts, but it's also exciting, this opportunity to be more deliberate about what kind of society we want to build. But I think the foment is happening not just at the human level. I think the reason there's been an acceleration of disclosure, if I can put it that way, if you look at what's been happening between US Congress and the Pentagon, surrounding disclosures about the legacy program there. If you look at what's been spoken publicly by people like Haim Eshed, former chief of space security for Israel, it suggests to me that the watertight policy of non-disclosure and covert presence of our visitors is leaking like a sieve. And I think the disagreements as to what should happen in the years to come are, I think, nothing's set in stone. So I think what we're seeing in geopolitics is probably mirroring at that layer as well. But it coincides, as I say, with this period where I think People are very curious. People are not accepting of meta-narratives they may have accepted for centuries. And I think that at an individual level, and this is in part flowing out of our experience of lockdowns, having the opportunity to pursue our curiosity on Google and YouTube, and thankfully in book reading as well. I think there's a lot of fresh imagining of the world and fresh decision making. I mean, I'm part, for instance, of a massive migration in Australia from, nothing personal, Drew, but from Victoria and from New South Wales into Queensland, because so many Australians have made decisions to do with how they've been governed, but also how much land they want to own, how self-sufficient they might want to be, what kind of climatic environment they want to live in. On an American scale, we had a 2-year period. If it was on an American scale, it would be something like 150,000 people migrating a month into half a dozen states from all the others. And that's what's happened to Queensland, because people are getting more intentional and making fresh decisions about how they live their lives. So all that is in the mix right now. It's a great time to be following your curiosity. It's a great time to be deciding what kind of life do I want to live? What kind of society do I want to contribute to? And so I think that intentionality is probably the point I'd finish with, to be deliberate about what you're going to do with your mental energy, what emotion you want to live your life in today, what energy you want to put out into the world today, how you want people to feel after their interactions with you today. I think if more and more of us can be intentional in that way, we put ourselves in a climate where we're capable of thinking new thoughts and making fresh decisions and charting better courses.
Love it. What a great way to wrap it up. Thank you again, Drew. I will put your, links and everything in the show notes. And of course, Paul, I'll put yours also in the show notes. You can find him at paulanthonywallace.com. You can get his books there or on Amazon and also thefifthkind.com. Did I get that right?
Fifthkind.tv.
Oh, dot TV. I always screw those up. Thanks again, you guys. We appreciate it so much, and we
Thank
will
you.
Talk to you all next time we do this. Have a great night.
Thank you for listening to Legit Bad. Please address all content grievances to gofuckyourself@yourmom.com. See you next week.